But such a farms as Grecian goldsmiths make, of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a gold bough to sing, to lords and ladies of Byzantium, of what is past, or passing, or to come. William Butler Yeats. Father Michael did not like living in England. He especially disliked being confined to Huddersfield, although it was an exciting place these days, with important people from all over the world passing through to learn about the cure for the plague. He accepted Doheny's reason for sending him to Huddersfield. Kate O'Gara Browder was an Irish national treasure, and, more important, was sure to become a potent political implement. The woman in the tank! Father Michael thought her a rather silly young woman, but there was a tough core of self-determination in her, a thing Father Michael thought of as a peasant quality. There had been a fair amount of this quality in Father Michael's own mother, and he had recognized it immediately in Kate. She would be stubborn and even cruel when her own interests were involved. Give her a bit of power and she could become terrifying, unless her actions were leavened by a firm belief in God's wrath. Doheny had said, "You will go to her, to be her spiritual adviser," and that's true enough. "I know you for a good priest, Father. But you will also be there to see that she does nothing foolish that could be hurtful to Ireland. I do not trust the Brits. What could they possibly do? That's for you to discover." And here he was in the bosom of the Gaul, and had been for more than 2 months. As he walked across the campus toward his regular morning visit with Kate, Father Michael could feel the power of this place. A dangerous thing, yes. There were dangerous currents here. Plots and strange devising, so he was glad he had come, even though he detested the British flavor of everything that happened here. His own motives for accepting Doheny's assignment had begun with simple curiosity, but had been hardened by the need to get the boy out of Ireland. Father Michael still thought of the silent boy as the boy, although the lad now said he could be called Sean. No last name. He refused to say anything about his family. It was as though the boy had walled them off in some secret grave where only he could mourn. The boy was determined to enter the priesthood. That was a consolation. Father Sean. He would be a strong priest, Father Michael thought, a compassionate priest, perhaps even a cardinal some day, and the possibility of Pope. There was that. Father Michael waited at a motor crossing for a long convoy to pass. It was going to be a sunny day, he thought. Hot, even. The convoy, he saw by the labels on the sides of the lorries, was part of the Wildlife Rescue Force. The telly was full of this good work, men shooting hypodermic darts into whales and porpoises and seals and wolves and bears and other creatures. It was a marvelous thing. Yes, the boy was far better off here than in the unrest of Ireland, with its fin-sail holdouts roaming the countryside. No doubt of the outcome now, though. The death of Kevin O'Donnell at the hands of the mob had robbed the Beach Boys of a mystical force. They had fought with brutal ferocity for a time, but without any central guidance. The devil himself, Father Michael thought. It was not the United Nations assistance to the army that had beaten the Fin Sail. It was when they lost the guiding hand of Satan. Kevin had been Satan personified. The convoy passed, and Father Michael crossed the roadway, to be almost run down there by a speeding jeep that came careening around a corner and dashed off after the lorries, the driver shaking a fist and screaming at the black-clad priest in his path. Some things never change, Father Michael thought. But it was better that the boy lived here now and was getting a fine education at the special school set up within the Huddersfield perimeter for selected students. They had accepted the boy because he was Father Michael's ward, and Father Michael had official status as an envoy of the Irish state. Yes, a fine scientific education, which could be reinforced later by the Jesuits in some safe place like America. Sean was going to be important some day. Father Michael had begun to sense this that day on the road above the besieged castle, when the boy had taken John O'Neill's hand and told the white lie to protect the poor man. Given the obvious things there must be in the boy's background urging him toward revenge, it had been a grand gesture, a true turning of the other cheek. Doheny had thought it merely clever and guileful, but Father Michael had known better. It had been right. There were a great many people on the Huddersfield campus this morning, Father Michael noted, rushing about, brushing past him. The place got more cluttered with people every day. Some of the passers-by recognized Father Michael and nodded. Others smiled vaguely, knowing they had seen him somewhere. "You saw me right here, you Sassenach fools!" Immediately Father Michael put this thought down as unworthy of him. He must learn magnanimity from the boy. Strange, the rumors and stories coming out of Ireland about O'Neill. He was seen here, he was seen there, but never a confirmation. 'Twas said that people were putting out food and drink for him, the way they had once done for the little people. Ah, there was no accounting for the Irish behavior. Look at the hero they were making of Bran MacRae, and him with 26 of those young girls pregnant. But he saved almost 50 Irish women, they were saying. Saved. What good was it saving their flesh if their souls were lost? It was not as though MacRae were the only one who had saved women from the plague. They were saying it would be generations before all the stories were told of how women had been secreted and protected by their clever men. Not enough saved, though. But efforts would be made to bring them all back to God, even the poor girls at MacRae's chateau. It had not been their doing. They had been caught by the troubled times. As he neared the administration building, where Kate and her husband were quartered, Father Michael saw the usual long line of men waiting to be threaded past the viewing window where Kate could be seen. Just to see a woman was a magnetic thing, so powerful that the authorities could not deny the demands. Too dangerous, they said. And what harm did it do? It harms Kate, Father Michael thought. Just showing herself was bringing about changes in the woman that Father Michael feared. Was this the thing Doheny had warned against? Father Michael made his way past the waiting men, hearing the bits of conversations. "She's a pretty thing, I hear, and with a baby out her breast." Father Michael saw resentment in the faces of the men he passed. They knew he had a right to push ahead, but there was a jealous awareness here that he could go in and talk to Kate, even touch her. The line of men wound in a long serpentine up the stairs inside the building. Father Michael ignored the stairs and went to the lift at the center of the long corridor. The guard at the lift opened the door for Father Michael and punched the button for the top floor. Father Bernie Cavanaugh was waiting outside the lift as Father Michael emerged on the top floor. There was no getting around the man, and Father Michael was forced to stop.
"Ah, there you are, Father Michael. I've been waiting for you."
Where had the Brits found this priest? Father Michael wondered. Oh, Cavanaugh was a Catholic priest, right enough. That had been confirmed. But he had been too long with the Gaul. He even spoke with the accents of an old Etonian.
"What is it you want?" Father Michael demanded. "Just a word or two, Father."
Cavanaugh took Father Michael's arm and almost forced him into a corner beyond the lift. Father Michael stared down at the other priest. Cavanaugh was a cherubic little man with pale cheeks. There was an insecurity in his blue eyes, which seemed always to be looking for an avenue of escape. Did he ever comb that gray hair? Father Michael wondered. It always seemed to have just come through a whirlwind. A good Irishman, he claimed to be. And wasn't he out of St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, the same as Father Michael? Had he gone through the troubles there? Father Michael had inquired, seeking to trap the man in a lie.
No. I was sent out 10 years before.
And that had proved to be true enough. But Cavanaugh was seeing Kate and talking to her, and Father Michael did not like the mood of the woman when Cavanaugh had gone. The man was thick with the papal envoy who had come over from Philadelphia, too, and Father Michael did not like what he heard about that. There was talk of an accommodation with the demands of these changing times. Father Michael knew what that meant. Backsliding. Nothing good would come of it. There might even be a new schism. How could anyone respect a Catholic Church with its administrative seat in America? Things would not get back to normal until Rome was restored. "You cannot go in to Kate just now," Father Cavanaugh was saying, his eyes avoiding Father Michael's. "She has an important visitor." "Who is it now?" "The Admiral over all the Barrier Command, the one who saved her by permitting the Channel Passage." "God saved her," Father Michael protested. "Of that there is no doubt," Cavanaugh agreed. "But it was the Admiral's command that gave her passage." "The Channel would have parted if God had wanted it," Father Michael said.
"I agree," Cavanaugh said. "But the Admiral has his powers, and we cannot disturb him just now. It's for her own good, I assure you."
"Why is he seeing her?" Father Michael demanded.
"As to that, I'm not at liberty to say."
Father Michael put down a surge of anger. He knew Cavanaugh sensed it, because the man released Father Michael's arm and stepped back defensively.
"What is happening in there?" Father Michael asked, keeping his voice under careful control.
"There's guards on the door, and you'll not be permitted to enter," Cavanaugh said. "I promise you, there's no harm coming to her." Father Michael sensed truth in Cavanaugh's words, and wondered if it would be right to force the issue.
"I am an envoy of the Irish state."
But that had its strictures, too. An envoy must behave with proper decorum. He sensed Doheny's fears coming true. That silly woman was famous all over the world. The woman in the tank. Something about her had caught the public fancy. It was the press doing it, of course. All of those sensational stories. And the baby being born during the storm of the Channel crossing.
"When will I be permitted to see her?" Father Michael asked.
"Perhaps this afternoon sometime. Would you care to wait in my quarters, Father? They've given me digs just down the corridor here." Father Michael felt a hollow hardness in his stomach. Something bad was happening, and he was to be kept out of it. Well, he would fight. Before he could speak, though, three armed naval officers came down the corridor, their attention on him. Father Michael knew then that he was to be a prisoner, and these were his guards. Our world undermines at its peril the individual's own sense of worth, that force at the root of human strength. This is our survival we undermine, our ability to deal with challenge. It is an inborn capacity, without which there can be no humanity. Fintan Craig Doheny. Kate liked to sit by the window of her new room on the top floor of Huddersfield's administration building when she nursed her baby. She knew the big mirror across from her was actually a window permitting the lines of men passing in the outside corridor to peer in at her. She had only to look up into the mirror to see what the passing viewers saw. She found it odd that she felt no embarrassment to know men watched her suckling Gilla at her breast. What a beautiful infant Gilla was becoming. The way her feet kicked, the wrinkles smoothing out, the look of alertness beginning to appear in her eyes. She was going to have red hair, fine and silky the way Kate's own mother's hair had been. How precious this infant was. There had been a bad few days when they brought the serum and told her their decision. So cold-blooded they had sounded, and she had screamed at the hulking Dr. Beckett, that ugly lantern-jawed man with his gigantic mouth and the awful words coming out of it. "You and your husband can have many daughters, Mrs. Browder. You've already demonstrated that, and with our new techniques of genetic control, we can ensure that you have only daughters." Men in white coats had been holding her all through this, keeping her away from Gilla, not even letting Stephen be with her. Beckett, an angry light in his eyes, had shouted at her, "We've only enough serum for you, Mrs. Browder."
"Give it to Gilla."
No. If your blood picks up fast enough, we can give your blood serum to the baby. We may be able to save her.
Maybe,
she had screamed. But there had been no resisting the strong men, and that was the way it had been. Her arms strapped down, a needle in it. She had lived through dreadful days, rocking Gilla and sobbing, fearing every moment that she would see the terrible plague symptoms in the infant. After the injection, Stephen had been permitted to come to her. Sounding almost like a priest, he had pleaded with her to be calm and accept whatever God gives us. Stephen and the drugs had tried to be soothing, but she could still think back to that time and feel the awful tremors in her stomach. Gilla at her breast restored the calm. The blood serum had been produced in time, and now everyone was giving blood serum. It was spreading out across the world like a wave. The door behind Kate opened, and she saw Stephen enter, the cautious movements. She saw him in the mirror, the way he looked at the mirror, not liking it, but accepting the necessity. He had seen the long lines out there, the avid eyes peering in at mother and child. Stephen was resisting extensions of the viewing time, but Kate was not sure this was right. In the whole world, the ratio of men to women was said to be 10,000 to 1, or worse. Here in England, of course, it was worse, although women saved by resourceful men were still being found and inoculated. A great new barracks establishment had been set up at Aldershot, where the women were being protected. Kate wondered how those women felt about her own special status. The first one saved. The woman in the tank. She knew there was pressure to get her back to Ireland, but she and Stephen were agreed that it was not yet safe. There were still beach boys with weapons roaming loose. And there were even women survivors being found in Ireland, although the stories of their tribulations filled Kate with horror. Troubles. That was all Ireland ever seemed to experience.
I was lucky.
She sensed the power in her position. She was a symbol in a world agog with the announcements being made from Changsha and Huddersfield. Despite her nurse's training, she found some of the things being said almost too much to accept. Was it possible that she and Gilla might live 5,000 years or more? They were saying that they could assure from conception whether a baby would be male or female, and that the female birth ratio was going to be held at very high levels until the balance had been restored. Kate found the thought of a 5,000-year lifetime difficult to imagine. 5,000 years. What would she do with all of that time? There would have to be more than producing babies, although she knew this would be her duty for years to come. Duty. Hard from the mouth of a priest. It was a male word. A legal judgment. There would be no escaping it. She and Stephen must produce more daughters. There were compensations, though. Kate found she rather liked her present female eminence, sensing that she must take advantage of it while she could. It would not endure in the face of this new genetic science. While it lasted, it was exciting. The men paying court to her. That was the only way to describe it. Courting. Not flirtation or simple attempts at seduction. The men were serious, and it enraged Stephen. Kate saw in the mirror that Stephen had taken a chair by the smaller window behind her, the one looking out over the Huddersfield campus. The way he pretended to sit there reading his book. He was making a statement to the passing viewers. This one is mine. She liked that. Kate could feel the love of Stephen, a warm current all through her body. A bond of terrible strength had been welded between them in the confinement of the isolation tank. She knew tiny, detailed things about him now, weaknesses and strengths.
He saved my life.
Each suckling movement of the baby, drawing life's own milk from her breast, amplified the waves of loving heat she felt for Stephen. She sensed it deep in her abdomen. The courting men were interesting, though, especially the Russian, Lepikov. What a charming man!
old-world charm. How amusing he was, lifting those thick black eyebrows at her, rolling his dark eyes. Poor man. His entire family dead somewhere in the Soviet Union. She felt so sad when she thought of it. How she wanted to cradle his head on her breast and comfort him. Stephen would never permit that, though. Its stomach full, the baby turned away from her breast and drifted into sleep, a tiny bubble of milk on her lips. Kate smiled down at her daughter, taking her time about covering herself. Gilly was such a fascinating person to watch. The miniature face in innocent repose, that little dimple on her left cheek. What a blessing. What a miracle. Kate glanced at her wristwatch. 10:10 a.m. She held the watch to her left ear. It still ran perfectly after all this time. She thought sadly of her mother presenting the watch to her the day Kate had gone off to nursing school.
Oh, Mama, I wish you could see your own granddaughter, your own flesh and blood, alive and happy.
Perhaps it was a blessing, though, that Mama could only look down from heaven at this scene. A terrible price was being asked of women. Secondary husbands. And even more. Kate felt a thrilling shiver at what she might be asked to accept. And how strange it was that the two priests disagreed on this question. She dared not even raise the problem with Stephen. She knew how he would react. The tiny steel chamber with its ever-sounding air pump had created a singleness between them, though, and she suspected that Stephen knew what she was thinking. "The priest's here," Stephen said. Just from his tone and before she looked up, Kate knew it was Father Cavanaugh and not Father Michael. Stephen liked Father Michael and barely tolerated Cavanaugh. Kate found this difficult to understand. Father Michael had married them back in Ireland, but he was such a hard man, that hoarse face never smiling. Father Cavanaugh, however, was jolly and soothing. He spoke of a happy God who wanted pleasant things for his flock. Father Michael was stern and threatening. He liked to talk philosophy with Stephen. It got so boring at times. Father Cavanaugh brought up a chair and seated himself in front of Kate, their knees almost touching. "And how are we today?" Father Cavanaugh asked, his voice booming. "Gil is looking as fine as a sunny day, and it full of spring flowers." Kate could see in the mirror how Stephen sneered at this. She knew what he was thinking. Cavanaugh was a bit absurd with his Irish phrasings uttered in that odd English accent. The priest leaned forward and tweaked one of Gilla's toes. The baby made a scowling face, but resumed her innocent sleep when he removed his hand. "Now, Kate," he said, "there's a rare light of health in your face. Have you need for anything special today? Is your heart at peace?"
"I never felt better, Father."
"It's what comes from the cure," Father Cavanaugh intoned. "It strengthens the body. Look how the injections have helped your little Gilla overcome the effects of being born prematurely."
"It's a miracle," she agreed.
"God is bountiful." He patted her knee and stood, letting his hand linger until he was upright.
"Are you going so soon, Father?" she asked.
"They asked me to make it short today. There's an important visitor waiting to see you."
"Isn't that a wonder?"
"You're a very precious person, Kate. I remember you and Gilla in the Mass every morning." With a stiff smile for Stephen, Father Cavanaugh left them.
"A visitor?" Kate asked.
Gilla whimpered. Kate bounced her gently, keeping her attention on Stephen.
"I haven't any idea," Stephen said.
He looked at Kate.
"They haven't said a thing."
Kate shuddered. She sensed danger, aware of a difference. Yes. There was no more sound of people shuffling past the mirror window. The air in the room smelled suddenly stale and full, touched by faint tobacco aroma that the priest always left behind. The door where the priest had gone opened suddenly, and Rupert Stoner entered with a stranger in a naval uniform. The stranger had wide shoulders and long arms. His face was extremely narrow, with an enormous Roman nose that overshadowed a small mouth and sharp chin. His eyes were set too close together, Kate thought, but the lashes were long and curved. She knew Stoner, though, and looked a question at him.
"May I introduce Admiral Francis Delacourt?" Stoner said. "The Admiral, as you may know, is the chief of Barrier Command, and, since the outrage in New York, is effectively head of the United Nations. It was Admiral Delacourt who saved you by sending a barge and tug when the Irish Civil War started."
"We are very grateful," Stephen said.
He shook hands with the Admiral, feeling a brief, muscular grip in a dry hand. Delacourt turned to Kate then, and bent over her hand, kissing it.
"Charmed," he said.
Kate blushed and looked down at the baby. Gilla took that moment to empty her bladder.
"Oh, my," Kate said, passing the baby to Stephen. "Would you change her, dear?"
Stephen took the baby, feeling the warm dampness.
"The nappies are in the other room," Kate said.
She smiled up at the Admiral.
"I've never met a real Admiral before."
"I'll just go along with you, Stephen," Stoner said, taking Browder's arm. "The Admiral has a request to make of Kate."
"What request?"
Stephen asked, feeling a sudden chill in Stoner's manner.
"The request is of Kate O'Gara, not of you," Stoner said, pressing Stephen along.
"That's Kate Browder. I'm her husband."
Stephen planted his feet and refused to be moved.
"Oh, I guess you haven't heard," Stoner said.
"Women will no longer take a husband's name. Matrilineal descent has been made a matter of law, the father's name being secondary."
"What law?" Stephen demanded.
"The law of this world."
"It's a United Nations thing," Stoner said, trying to press Stephen out of the room.
"I'm not leaving," Stephen said. "Let go of my arm."
"Be careful," Kate cried. "You'll hurt the baby."
"Let it be," Admiral Delacourt said. "He should be present, even though the request is of the lady."
Stoner released Stephen's arm, but remained standing beside him.
"What request?" Stephen asked.
"I lost my entire family in the plague," Delacourt said. "My request is that this lady give me a child."
Stephen started to move toward him, the baby held foolishly in his arms, but Stoner restrained him with an arm across his chest.
"Be careful of the baby, you idiot!"
Stoner grabbed Stephen's arm and held it firmly.
"Why does such a request shock you?" the Admiral asked, looking at Stephen. "Surely you must realize it is the norm now. There are so few women. It's just that I do not wish my line to die out."
Kate got to her feet, brushing at her skirt. A glance in the mirror told her there was a big wet spot from the baby in the middle of her lap. She looked pale, she saw.
"Are there no other women to—"
She couldn't complete it.
Stoner spoke while still holding Stephen, who permitted it for fear of harming Gilla.
"Tell him, Kate," Stephen thought. "Tell him to get the hell out of here with his evil request."
Stephen grew aware gradually of what Stoner was saying. So few women being sent to the devastated areas. China, Argentina, Brazil, and the United States are the only nations that have consented, by local option, to share their breeding women, Stoner said. England will get little more than 1,000 of them.
Like cattle, Kate thought.
She looked at the Admiral. He was a powerful man, the head of Barrier Command. That meant warships and the backing of the United Nations. Accepting him could keep worse things from happening. She looked pleadingly at Stephen.
Couldn't he see it?
Her resolution of only a few minutes ago now seemed like a silly schoolgirl thing that she had suddenly outgrown.
"Could you return in about a half hour, please, Admiral?" she asked.
"Stephen and I need a little time to talk."
She smiled at Stoner.
"Mr. Stoner, could you change Gilla for us?
The nappies are in that little cabinet at the foot of her crib."
Stoner took the baby from Stephen's unresisting hands. The Admiral smiled at Kate and bowed over her hand. He had already heard her answer in her tone of voice. She was a sensible woman, almost French in her manner. Perhaps they would have more than one child together. In the other room, Stoner dropped the side of the crib and placed the baby on it. Gilla kicked her feet at him and gurgled with delight as he removed the wet diaper. The Admiral helped him, both of them smiling at the thought of this scene. The two of them doing a nanny's work. "She's going to accept you," Stoner said. You heard that in her voice, too. The Admiral lifted the baby and smiled at her. Was that a smile in return, or just gas, as they said? I could almost pick her myself, Stoner said. But I could never forget that she's Irish. Good God, man, you aren't still harping on... My only son was killed during the bloody amnesty in Belfast. After the plague. He was a paratroop officer. They tortured him to death. Oh, I am sorry. The Admiral put the baby over his shoulder and patted her, feeling very fatherly. He had been well briefed on the troubles in Ulster. An Irish-Canadian had spent several hours at it. What was really at the root of it in the north was the Ulsterman's fear that the Catholics would institute just reprisals for all of the oppressions of the past. 2 generations a Canadian, and the man had still sounded like an angry Irishman as he handed the Admiral a copy of an Ulster pamphlet signed by someone named William Boyce, commander of the Belfast Brigade. Now these were the things we rightly feared should the Catholics of the South prevail over us. Divorce prohibited, contraception illegal, no health plans, all of the things you find in the era constitution. We know about the Catholic families. At least 12 children in every one, all of them living in hovels and slums. Beggars in the streets, the whole dirty lot. Do you think we'll really be able to outlaw contraception? The Admiral asked. Of course. With the Church behind us, how can we fail?
The failure of civilization can be detected by the gap between public and private morality. The wider the gap, the nearer the civilization to final dissolution. Jost Hopp.
Bill Beckett sat alone in the VIP lounge of Air Force One, insulated from the jet sounds by expensive soundproofing. The place smelled of leather and good whiskey. He glanced at his wristwatch. 10:28 EST. The parade was scheduled to start at 1 p.m. in Washington, D.C. He stared at all the empty seats around him, thinking of what this privileged isolation really meant. Ruckerman, who slept now back in the private bedroom, had chortled at sight of the plane.
Numero uno, by God!
The president had sent this plane especially for the two of them, a full general to escort them and brief them on the ceremonies awaiting them in Washington. A parade, addresses to the joint session of Congress, medals, a banquet in the White House. The general, a Walter Monk, had looked too young for the job. All smiles and white teeth, but cruel eyes. Ruthless. Beckett sighed. It was all true what Marge had babbled to him over the telephone.
You're a hero, I tell you.
What a strange conversation. The girls squealing and crying, telling him how much they loved him, how famous he was, then passing the phone back to Marge with,
Mother has something real important to tell you. There's talk of you running for president, Marge said.
My God. He couldn't absorb it all. He had been too close to the plague project for too long, his vision restricted to the day-by-day demands of their research. And Marge springing the next revelation on him with never a hint to prepare him, not one single clue in any of their few scanty telephone and radio contacts. It had almost overloaded the system.
Bill, I don't want you to worry. You're my primary and always will be.
Primary. How quickly the jargon took over. But he knew then what she was about to announce. The secondary marriage between Kate O'Gara and Admiral Francis Delacourt had set the pattern.
You'd better know it before you arrive, though, darling, Marge said. It'll be so obvious when you see me. I'm pregnant.
He could hear the girls behind her chattering.
Tell him about...
The rest was lost as Marge continued.
Didn't you hear me, Bill?
I heard you.
You sound all tight and angry the way you do. Bill, you've got to accept this.
I accept it.
The father is Arthur Dalvig, darling. General Dalvig. He's our regional military commander. You'll like him. I know you will.
What choice do I have?
Bill, don't be that way. He's been very good to us. The girls love him. And, darling, he has made a great many things possible. When things were at their worst, he protected us and everything.
Darling, please. He knows he's only my secondary, that you'll always be first with me.
He accepts that. Arthur admires you, Bill. He's one of those saying you should be president.
And why not? Beckett thought. A president in the family can be a powerful career advantage for a military officer.
I love you, Bill,
Marge said. And the girls squealing behind her,
tell him about...
Again it was lost. Whatever the girls wanted told, as Marge said, she would save the rest of it until he arrived. Then,
oh, girls, all right. They want me to tell you about all the men who are courting them, but they're too young.
They'll have to wait until they're at least 15, and that's final. He was going home to a very different world than the one he had left, Beckett realized. And so was Joe. Poor Hupp. His dreams of being a power broker, dispensing the scientific largesse with a careful hand, all gone. A cruel awakening into this new civilization.
We are cows, Hupp had said.
This had brought shocked silence to the other members of the team, all four of them holding their last meeting, parting, finally, in the impersonal crockery, tile, and chromium of Huddersfield's main cafeteria. There had been much noisy activity out beyond their corner table. Huddersfield had become a world crossroads, every facility overloaded.
Joe is upset because our old team is breaking up, Lepikoff explained.
Joe is right, Danza said.
You were not raised on the land as we were, Sergei, Hupp said. You would not understand about poor dumb cows. You never walk up to your cow and abuse it with your anger.
Danza nodded sagely.
You talk sweetly to your cow, Hupp said. You feed it well. You brush it and clean it and give it the best medical care. You treat it gently but firmly, just the way Stoner and his friends treat us. They know about cows. When the cow's head is in the stanchion, you lock the head there. Then you draw out the lovely, rich milk, being careful to strip out the last of the milk at the end, lest the poor creature get sick on what is left in it.
Beckett had recounted this to General Monk during the first part of the flight, watching the amusement and speculation in the man's eyes. How was a possible President of the United States taking to such an insight? This was one cow who was going to be bullish, Beckett thought. After Monk left him alone, Beckett began framing a campaign speech. We need a scientist in the White House. We need someone who knows the real dangers facing our world. We need someone capable of assessing the true nature of what our scientific laboratories produce. Yes. Give them the idea that the plague might not have occurred had there been a scientist president. That would do it. A woman for every man. It was a good slogan, and might be an attainable goal. The idea carried dangerous undertones of ownership, though. Were women to be hostages to a human future? Hupp had been absolutely right about one thing. They need us, damn them. There was mounting evidence that O'Neill had created more than he knew in that crude laboratory of his. Now that people were once more moving about, crossing the old borders and the new ones, diseases never before observed were beginning to crop up. O'Neill had probably been a walking factory of infections. They could trace his path by where the new diseases were appearing.
God! One man had done this.
Was O'Neill still wandering insane in Ireland?
It was possible.
A form of that primitive respect for madness had come over the Irish. They were perfectly capable of harboring him, feeding and protecting him. The stories coming out of Ireland could not be discounted. Rumors, myths. Cottagers were putting out dishes of food the way they once had done for the little folk. But now it was for the madman. And the stories they told, and the press repeating them.
I heard this screaming at night. Away down in the vale it was, and not a human sound at all. It was the madman, sure. The milk I left out for him was gone in the morning.
This concludes The White Plague. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 1-877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.